Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo companies for shipments to rural Alaska for business and home. More at CostcoBusinessDelivery.com.
Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Our children can be affected by a variety of pediatric endocrine disorders. Some conditions may be more well-known to adults, like diabetes and thyroid disorders, while others are more unique and challenging to identify, such as vitamin D deficiency and rickets, early or delayed puberty, short stature, and pituitary gland disorders. The symptoms of these disorders may not be straightforward, and thus the issue can be difficult to identify. Some of these pediatric endocrine disorders are diagnosed at a higher rate in Alaska than in the lower 48. How are these inherited and non-inherited endocrine disorders diagnosed, and what treatments are available? Joining us today is our expert, pediatric endocrinologist, Dr. Rachel Lesher. She has provided care for over a decade throughout our state of Alaska as part of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. After medical school, she completed her pediatrics training at the University of California, Irvine, and then completed a pediatric endocrinology fellowship at Washington University in St. Louis. Dr. Lesher, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. And you can also join our conversation. Do you have a question about hormone or endocrine disorders in your child? Have you had a recent diagnosis in your family and need to find resources? Are you noticing changes in your child and need to know what steps to take for evaluation? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. Lesher, as a lover of hormones myself and hormone management in adults, there's so much I want you to share with us today. But tell me, or tell all of us, a little bit more about endocrinology. What is it? What organ systems are involved?
So endocrinology is the study and understanding of the endocrine system. The endocrine system is a connection of glands that are sending messages, which are hormones, throughout the bloodstream to tell the rest of the body what to do. So I always like to joke that the heart and brain are super important, but they just do what the hormones tell them to do. And basically, the system works through feedback loops, which are communications where one gland or organ will send a hormone to another gland, tell it what to do, and then that target organ or gland sends the message back to the original gland to say, hey, I did what I was told.
That's a really great description. I like that. Yes, heart and brain important, but they follow the directions of the hormones. Excellent. Well, what sparked your desire to enter this specialized path?
So I first became interested in endocrinology when I first learned about feedback loops. I super nerded out on them during my physiology class in college, and I just really liked how the whole system was connected and communicated with each other. It was very logical. I grew up doing logic puzzles with my dad, and I just really like things that fit together. And then when you're doing endocrinology and you're looking at disease, you can see a child and take a history, do an exam, collect blood work, and then you can sort of pinpoint where the breakdown in that communication system is. And then you can find ways to repair it, which I think is also kind of fascinating and rewarding. Plus, our patients are super cute and lovely, so that always helps.
Yeah, I always joke the kids have to be cute for us to put so much work into them.
Fortunately, all children are cute,
they
so
are
it
so
works
cute.
Out good.
Well, I really like that, you know, everything is interconnected, which is good and bad. You know, sometimes that's difficult because you can't just treat one thing. You know, you kind of have to treat the whole system. So just tell us a bit about some of our body's major hormones.
Yeah, so there's a few major glands. Starting at the top, there's the pituitary gland and hypothalamus. They are kind of in the center of the brain. And the pituitary is considered the master gland of the body. It sends hormones to almost all of the other glands in the body. And then we have the thyroid gland, which is in the center of the neck, and it controls metabolism. I like to think of it as the Goldilocks hormone. It keeps everything running at just the right speed, not too fast, not too slow. And then we have the parathyroid glands, which control calcium, along with the bones and kidneys that also help control calcium. And then the pancreas, which is in the center of the belly, and that controls insulin, which helps maintain our sugar homeostasis, keeps our blood sugars in balance, and helps it go into the tissues to be used for energy. And then we have the adrenal glands, which make several different hormones. And primarily we think about cortisol, which is the hormone that keeps us alive. So when you get sick, you need to make cortisol to stay alive. And then we have the reproductive sex organs, the testicles or ovaries, that help us go through puberty, help us develop the external sex organs, and help us have reproduction and fertility.
I don't know if I've heard anyone break it down as well as you just did. Thank you very much for that. Well, I know in some adults, hormone dysfunction occurs as a natural part of aging or occurs naturally during puberty. How early can hormone or endocrine disorders present themselves in children?
We can see endocrine conditions present at birth or even in the fetus. So kids can be born with intersex conditions where there was a problem during the embryology formation of the internal or external reproductive organs, for example, the adrenal glands, the thyroid gland, all of those things are being formed in utero, and then they could not form correctly. There can be genetic mutations that doesn't allow an enzyme to work the way it's supposed to or doesn't allow a structure to form the way it's supposed to. So we can see things right at birth, and then kids can also acquire various hormone diseases throughout life.
What kind of testing is done here in Alaska to identify these both inherited and non-inherited disorders?
So we have the Alaska State Newborn Screening Program. Newborn screening is mandated throughout the country, and Alaska was actually one of the pioneers with newborn screening for congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which is an increase in our population. And so the newborn screening is that little blood spot. So every baby who's born in Alaska at 24 hours of age, they get a little poke in their heel, collect some blood onto a blood card that gets mailed to a lab in Iowa that runs and processes all of those blood spot cards very quickly so that we can diagnose disease within the first few days of life.
What about children that aren't born in the hospital?
They are still tested. So at birthing centers, if people are born at home, the midwife or doula or birthing provider, whoever is helping with the birth, will perform the test at 24 hours. And if someone is born without a birthing provider, then their pediatric provider, primary care provider, will perform the test at 24 hours.
Are there any children that are getting missed, or are we, you know, pretty good with making sure that all of our children are tested?
We have a very robust system in Alaska. Lori Fulmer is our newborn screening coordinator, and she is a rock star. So she really works to make sure that we don't miss any children.
Oh. Well, you mentioned congenital adrenal hyperplasia being more pronounced in our population. I believe I heard that it was increased in our UPIC population here. So let's talk a little bit about that. What about this disorder can you tell us, and what are the problems that it causes?
So congenital adrenal hyperplasia, or CAH, which is way easier to say, yes, is a problem with the adrenal gland. The adrenal gland, there's two of them, and they're back by the kidneys and the belly. They make several different hormones, but one is cortisol, which is the hormone that we need to survive. And basically, there's an enzyme pathway that helps the body to make cortisol in response to a message from the pituitary gland. There's actually kind of, I like to think of it as three rivers. So one is making a hormone that controls salt, one is making the cortisol that controls sugar and keeps us alive, and then one is making hormones that are sort of like testosterone. And with CAH, there's a dam in two of those rivers, the salt one and the sugar one. So just like a beaver dam, you don't have water flowing down those rivers, and then everything floods and goes down the testosterone-like hormone pathway. And so those babies can be born with the inability to make salt, to make sugar, to keep their levels steady. Their blood pressure can be really low, and it's fatal if it's not treated. But when it is treated, then we're able to replace those hormones that aren't being made and stop the flooding into that other hormone system.
So the long-term consequences are that they don't survive, but with the treatment, do they have normal lifespans after that?
Typically they can. The treatment is very complicated. It requires lots of medicines that you're trying to give to a baby multiple times a day when you're also trying to feed the baby and get sleep and, you know, do all of the other things that you need to do with a brand new newborn. But with adequate treatment and close monitoring, lots of blood draws, lots of visits to the doctor, we can help these kids live a pretty normal life. There can be complications both from the disease and from the medications, but they're always doing research to try to find better ways to treat it as well.
Are there specific treatment options for girls when they're born with male-appearing genitalia? Or I don't know if you say ambiguous genitalia anymore. Are there treatment options for that?
Yes. So babies who are born with CAH, we think of them kind of in two ways. We know that there are lots of different intersex conditions, but with genetic females who have CAH, because they in utero were making more of the testosterone-like hormone, then they can have enlarged clitoris. They can have labia that may look a little bit more like a scrotum, obviously without testicles in it. And so sometimes those children may need surgery. Sometimes as an infant, if like the urethra, the duct that people urinate out of, is blocked. But most of the time they don't need any surgery. And then when they're older, like teenagers, they may need examination to make sure they can have periods. And then in some cases, older children with this may decide to have surgeries to address the genitalia. But surgery is not always required, often is not needed.
So you mentioned the urethra, where the urine comes out. So sometimes that urethra can be blocked. Is that being blocked by the size of the clitoris, or is there something more?
It's I'm not a urologist, but it is basically related to some of just the atypical way that the external genitalia are forming.
Like the embryological makeup of it.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Well, congenital, by definition, means that this is something that presents itself that you're born with. But I know that in my practice, I've diagnosed congenital adrenal hyperplasia in young adults. How likely is this that you would be diagnosed later in life?
Yeah, so there's many different types of CAH, depending on the enzyme defect and depending on the gene mutation that leads to that enzyme defect. The most common type of CAH that we think about is classic salt-wasting CAH, the one that I described that requires multiple medications right from birth. But then there can be non-classic CAH, also called late-onset CAH. And so some of those cases might be picked up later in infancy or in childhood if there's early pubic hair, for example, because of that extra testosterone. Or they may not be picked up until adolescence if they're having periods be irregular, or they may not be picked up until adulthood when they're having fertility issues. And the problem is that enzymes are not like all or nothing. So enzymes, I always think of, they're like when you're cooking, you know, you put things together and then the fire makes things happen, right? And so the enzymes make things happen. They change something from one thing to another. And the enzyme can be working a little bit, or it could be working a lot, or it could be working not at all. And so with various types of CAH, the enzyme might be working good enough to keep you alive, good enough to keep your sugars normal and your salt normal, but not good enough to prevent all of the flooding into that testosterone pathway. And so then that might lead to a problem later that just didn't get picked up early on in life, even though the disease is something you were still born with.
And then at that point, will we just go on to treating the symptoms that they've presented with since they have enough to get them through life?
Yeah, so many people with late onset or non-classic CAH do not need medications necessarily. It depends on the underlying problem. Mm-hmm. So if fertility is an issue, then they may need medications to help with that. Sometimes we still do treat with the same medication that we use in babies. It really just depends on the degree of severity of the enzyme defect.
Okay. Well, we have an email, and I think this will take us into our next subject very well, which will, I think we should talk about puberty. And we have this email from Shane in Anchorage that would like to know about testing for exogenous hormones. So hormones that could be found in Teflon chemicals or other chemicals in the body to determine if these exogenous hormones are a root cause of endocrine disorders like excessive weight gain or early breast development in females or males or high liver enzymes in adolescent males.
So we don't have validated ways to test and differentiate between hormones that came from outside versus the hormones that you make in your own body. So there's not really any validated ways to test for that. And we still are learning a lot about how endocrine disruptors, which I think is what they are referring to, endocrine disruptors are chemicals and things that are in the environment, that are in the soil, in the air, in the water, that can interact with our own endocrine system. And we're still learning a lot about how those disruptors interact with our bodies. So it's hard to know for sure how to test for those things and really even what they cause in terms of different disease processes.
So basically at this point, we are testing the hormone in your body. And then we can see if the amount of hormone you have is appropriate for the stage you are in life.
Correct.
Okay. That makes sense. Well, let's move on to puberty. And perhaps you can tell us about puberty and the average age at which puberty occurs, because I know there are a lot of disorders associated with puberty, whether it's early or whether it's late.
Yeah, so puberty is one of those things that kids are supposed to do. Whenever I'm talking with families, I say kids are supposed to do two things. They're supposed to grow and they're supposed to go through puberty. And so if those things are not happening on the right time or the right schedule or the right pace, then it may need further evaluation. So puberty's quite variable and probably changing a little bit with changes in diet and endocrine disruptors and other factors from, you know, generations ago till now. But generally, for the test, genetic females go through puberty sometime between the age of 8 and 13, should start puberty sometime at that age. And genetic males should generally start puberty sometime between the ages of 9 and 14. So if it's outside of that range, then it might not be normal. And then additionally, there's generally a pace that you go through puberty. So usually sometime over about 2 to 4 years. And sometimes it can be a little bit shorter, a little bit faster, a little bit slower. In general, though, that's how long we expect for puberty to take. So that process of the body changing should start somewhere in that time frame and last somewhere in that 2 to 4 years.
Can you explain to us what the start of puberty is? Because I think when a lot of people think about puberty, we think about, in girls, having a period. So when does puberty actually start?
So we think of, endocrinologists think of true puberty, and then there's other aspects of puberty. So true puberty in genetic females is the onset of breast development. Clinically. Now we can test for things that look at puberty, like looking at the estrogen levels, looking at the hormone levels. And basically what really happens at the beginning of puberty is that pituitary gland starts sending messages to the ovaries or testicles and telling them to start making the hormones that they need to make to cause those secondary sex characteristics. But what the first thing we see in a genetic female is breast development, so those little breast buds. And then in genetic males, the first thing that we'll see is the testicles start to grow. So those are not generally things that parents will often notice because it's very subtle at the beginning. So that's one of the reasons that we encourage people to take their kids in to see their primary care provider so that they can have those physical exams throughout life and detect those early signs of puberty early on.
So the primary care provider should be evaluating their genitalia.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In their breasts. Okay. And with girls and boys, when that onset of puberty happens outside of that range of ages you gave us, is that what is abnormal?
So it can be. I waffle a little bit because there's always variation, right? So whenever we think in averages, there's going to be a peak of what's normal, and then there can be what we call standard deviation, where there's just a little bit of range.
It's never easy.
It's never easy. But if it is outside of that range, or if it's going much more quickly than we expect, or much more slowly than we expect, or it's outside of the range of the family pretty significantly, then yes, it warrants evaluation. Sometimes it may just be monitoring. Sometimes there may be x-rays or labs, or sometimes you may need a referral to a specialist.
Is there an end to puberty?
Yes. So for genetic females, like I said, it typically is 2 to 4 years. There's what we call Tanner stages, or the more updated word is sexual maturity rating, or SMR. And the stage goes from 1 to 5. So 1 is no puberty and 5 is the end of puberty. So for genetic females, they usually start having periods around stage 4, and then kind of completion of puberty, or they basically are not, their breasts are not growing anymore, their periods are happening regularly, they're finished having pubic hair, and so then that is considered stage 5. And genetic males, they'll have full development and growth of the testicles and the penis, and then they will complete their pubic hair and complete their growth. So genetic males tend to have their growth spurt kind of at the end of puberty, around stage 4. So those are some of the harbingers of the end of puberty.
Interesting. And so the girls have their growth spurt more at the beginning of puberty?
Right. So females tend to have growth spurt around stage 2 to 3. And then, like I said, the males around stage 3 to 4, which makes sense because, you know, when you look at like a 6th grade classroom, all the girls are taller than most of the boys. And if you look at an 11th grade class, then most of the boys are taller than most of the girls. So we just all have our growth spurts at different stages. And it's related to the hormones again. So the estrogen is really what makes you grow, and you start making those estrogen hormones in males and females at different times.
Thank you. Well, what is the significance of puberty beginning early? Let's start with in a girl. What's the significance? Are there long-term effects to that?
It depends. So if puberty starts early in a female, it depends on how early, right? So if a 2 or 3 year old or 4 year old is having true puberty, where there's progression and things are changing, it may be due to, you know, a mass or something in the ovary or in the pituitary gland. So then there certainly could be long-term consequences of having to manage the underlying cause. If it's like 7 or 6 or something like that, and it's just the alarm clock went off a little bit early, then it may not need any treatment. It really depends on the degree and severity of puberty and how fast it's occurring. But the biggest thing we often think about as far as long-term effects is growth. So they can grow too fast, too soon, and then stop growing too early and end up shorter than they were meant to be.
So they may start off quite tall amongst their peers, but then overall at the end, if they initiate puberty earlier, they may not reach their predicted height.
Yep. So that's the same for all kids who have puberty, regardless of sex. If they're having puberty too early, they will grow too fast, too soon, and end up shorter than they were supposed to be.
And that's the same in boys as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you've shared a lot with us, but it's time for our first break, and then we'll talk a little bit more about puberty again when we return. You are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or comment for our guest today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. After this short break, we will continue our discussion of hormone disorders in kids with Dr. Rachel Lesher as Line 1 continues statewide.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're hurting in your relationship or have been affected by sexual violence, Strong Hearts Native Helpline is a free 24/7 confidential and anonymous domestic, dating, and sexual violence helpline for Alaska Natives. Help is available by calling or texting 1-844-7-NATIVE or using the chat icon at strongheartshelpline.org. This message is sponsored by the Strong Hearts Native Helpline.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined by guest Dr. Rachel Lusher, a pediatric endocrinologist that evaluates and treats hormone problems in newborns through adolescence at the Alaska Native Medical Center. She is a member of the Pediatric Endocrine Society, the Alaska Newborn Screening Committee, and of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Are you concerned that your child has displayed signs of early puberty? Are you concerned with the growth of your child? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So, why don't you tell us some of the concerns a parent or caregiver might have that would prompt them to take their child to see their pediatrician in terms of puberty or to see a pediatric endocrinologist?
Well, one of the biggest reasons that we'll often see a patient is if they started puberty too early, because that's something that people often tend to notice. A lot of times, unfortunately, we don't get to see them till puberty has been going on for a while, because maybe somebody didn't know that it was a potential problem, or especially with COVID and people haven't been going to their providers as much because of concerns about exposing their loved ones to COVID. So sometimes we will see it a little bit later, but those are some of the big things people might notice, is seeing those changes when they weren't expecting to.
Right. Well, what are some of the causes of early puberty?
Well, so the pituitary gland and hypothalamus are sort of the alarm clock. So that alarm clock is set in utero when it's supposed to go off, but certain things can make it go off early. And so sometimes it's just that the alarm clock went off early and we can just push the snooze button. Sometimes it's a mass or something in the hypothalamus or the pituitary gland in the brain that's causing those hormones to be made and sent to the ovaries or testicles. Or there could be a mass or something on the ovaries or testicles that are making too much of the hormones without getting that message from the brain. So those are not as common as just the alarm clock going off too early, but that is the thing that we're always evaluating for.
And I guess in the case of our email, they were talking about hormones, and maybe you can share with us some of the exogenous hormones that could exist that maybe your child may be exposed to.
Yeah, and that's, again, something that we're still learning about, but we do know for sure, like if someone in the home is using testosterone gel or a hormone-containing cream or something that might get onto the child, like during a hug or, you know, sleeping right in the same bed or whatever. Then I've definitely seen kids who've had early puberty because of exposure to those kinds of medications. And then we know that certain plants, like lavender, has phytoestrogens or plant-based estrogens. Soy has plant-based estrogens. And so if people are using a lot of that heavy exposure to lavenders or soy, for example, then sometimes we can see puberty come early from that. And then again, we're still learning about how those endocrine disruptors might affect the reproductive endocrine system.
Very interesting, because I know in so many of our products for our children, there's lavender. That's what they recommend for getting your child to settle down. And it's in your bath. It's in your cleansing products.
Yeah, I'm the worst at baby showers.
Incense, right? Yeah.
Everyone at baby showers is like, use lavender for your baby. And I'm like, don't. Maybe don't.
Let me take all that lavender away. Yes. Remove it all from your home. So what are the treatment options available?
It depends on the cause. Sometimes if there's central precocious puberty, meaning that the pituitary gland is making things happen too quickly, We can put kids on medications that pause it, basically push the snooze button on that alarm clock and wait until they're a little bit older. That medication is either through a shot or an implant. And then if it's because the testicle or ovary is making too much hormone, then it depends on why it's doing that. So sometimes it might require surgery. If there's like a mass, it might require certain medications to try to suppress that. It really just depends on the cause. And then there may be cases, especially with central precocious puberty, where we won't treat and we'll just let the child kind of go through puberty when their body wants to. And it really is a conversation that your provider has with the family and the child.
What is the downside to treating?
Well, with any medication, there's risk of side effects. And so we always sort of go through those side effects with each individual and how those side effects might be higher or lower chance in each individual child. And then it requires medical care, right? So going to the doctor every 3 months for a shot, those injections are not fun. They're big, giant needles that go into a big muscle. So that can be pretty traumatic. Or if they have an implant, that may require going under anesthesia and having surgery. So there's costs associated with that. So there's a lot of things that people may decide that it's just not worth it.
And are those same treatment options for girls available for boys?
Yep, all kids with puberty, with central precocious puberty. So we don't differentiate male or female when we think about treatment of central precocious puberty.
And is there a time where it's too late to pursue treatment?
There may be. So if puberty has really progressed quickly, then and they don't get seen until it's already finished, then it may be not really worth it. There's not going to be anything that we can change at that point.
And by finish, are you referring to finishing like you've had your period for the girls, or with males you've had your pubic hair and like the enlargement of the penis?
Yep. So if you're at stage 4 or 5 when you come to the pediatric endocrinologist for the first time and the growth plates have already closed and everything has already happened, then treatment isn't going to do anything in most cases. There's still maybe times when we would treat. So if a really young child's having periods and that's really difficult for them hygienically or whatever, we still may treat for a little while until they're a little bit older. If it's really late through puberty, then the risk of any side effects may not be worth any reward.
Okay. We're going to take a caller, but when we come back from that, I want you to talk a little bit more about the growth plate closure to make sure that's understood. But let's welcome Sue from Nome to line one. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Thanks for calling in.
I'm pulling over. Yeah. Well, this has been fascinating. And I wanted to ask, you know, I heard you very briefly mention the term intersex. And we're certainly hearing a lot more about kids with sexual dysphoria. They feel like they are a different, you know, gender than what their bodies reflect, as well as the whole big trans issue. And I would love to just, well, not get into the politics, but the biology. Where, you know, it seems like these must be endocrine occurrences. And just wondering if you could elaborate on that a bit, because it has become such a public topic, and I don't know how much we all know about, how much we really understand about it.
Sure. So intersex conditions are different from being transgender or gender non-binary or gender expansive. Intersex conditions are those in which during embryology, during the formation of the internal and external reproductive organs, something maybe went wrong or went different. And we try to use the word intersex or differences of sexual differentiation to describe that, where either the ovaries didn't form correctly, the testicles didn't form correctly, something's not functioning correctly, or down the line, things didn't form in the way that we expect them to. People who are transgender or non-binary do not have intersex conditions, so that is actually not a hormone problem. We don't have a full understanding of how anybody forms their gender identity. It's something that we're still learning about.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you for that call and the explanation. And I think that sparked some other questions about growth, actually. So we do have an email. And this one's about late onset puberty. Nikki started puberty at age 17. Currently, they are 5'11" and 125 pounds. With a normal thyroid and wanting to know if they should be tested for Marfan syndrome?
I would say that it would be a really great idea to speak with your primary care provider for that question. Like I said, there are variations in when people start puberty, but starting actually not having breast development until 17 is certainly beyond the age of what is expected. So we expect for some puberty in a female to start by 13 and in a male by 14. So definitely a good idea to get checked out.
So, yes, I think that's really good to mention. It's just if there's any question like that, there's no question that isn't a good question. So definitely take that in. And it seems like you've done some, you know, research to even know about Marfan syndrome. I don't know if you want to briefly talk about Marfan. You know, basically people who are, they're typically taller than others. So absolutely, there's no reason not to be checked except for, you know, the inconvenience of having to go in. But knowledge is power.
Absolutely. Yep. Doctors and providers are always happy to talk with patients about any question that you have.
So are there issues with late onset puberty?
Yes. The biggest sort of long-term concern about late onset puberty is bone health. So estrogen, particularly in males and females, all people make estrogen and all people make testosterone. We just make it in different proportions. And the estrogen specifically is important for the health and strength of the bones. And so if somebody's not having puberty during adolescence, so adolescence is that period between, you know, 13 and 18, and that is sort of the time that we put down all of the bone that we're going to have for the rest of our lives. And so that's why we make all these hormones at really high levels during that time to help strengthen those bones and help grow and develop those bones. And so if somebody's not having any hormone production, sex hormone production during those years, then they can potentially have low bone density or poor bone health and increase the risk for fractures later in life.
Thank you. Well, speaking of growth, can you discuss again the correlation between puberty and the growth plate closure or fusion?
Yeah, so growth is one of those other things that all children are supposed to do. They're supposed to grow. And we have big growth periods during infancy. So during infancy, you grow really fast early on, as many families know. And then you start slowing down after about 1 to 2 years of age. And then at between like 5 and puberty, you grow at about 2 inches a year. And then when puberty starts, so in a female, that will be early on in puberty, they'll start growing really fast again, about 4 to 5 inches a year. And then for a male, sort of late in puberty, they'll start growing about 4 to 5 inches a year. Growth is controlled by many factors, like the caller mentioned, thyroid helps control growth, especially in babies. Growth hormone helps control growth, especially after 1 or 2 years of age, after the thyroid's done its part the most. And then the sex hormones like estrogen and testosterone control growth, especially during puberty. So all of these hormones work together to help us grow, which is why if you're not growing, it's good to get checked out because it could be any number of hormone problems or non-hormone related problems.
So very complex. It's good to have our expert, the pediatric endocrinologist. And so many causes, you know, we're thinking about puberty leading to growth issues. But as she mentioned, there are other causes of growth issues. And like our emailer mentioned with Marfans and having longer limbs and being very tall, and it can be associated with cardiac defects. So these are all reasons to have evaluations. And some of these evaluations may be many, you know, maybe simple blood tests and genetic testing, where others may be x-rays of their wrist for their bone age. So all things that your pediatrician would be probably the first step. Even at 17, you can see your pediatrician. Well, aside from puberty and growth issues, there are other growth issues outside of puberty for those who are a shortened stature. So when should a parent see their pediatrician if they're concerned that their child isn't growing and they've already ruled out puberty?
Mm-hmm. So, yep, short and tall stature are things that you will often see an endocrinologist for. Again, growth is something that we measure at ideally every visit. Every time you go see the doctor, your child should have their height measured. Sometimes they only do it at the well child checks, although I encourage it to be done at every visit so you can catch problems before they occur. And so when you go to the provider, then you will get your height measured and it gets plotted on a growth chart, which are validated by the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control. And then those measurements over time can be used to make sure that kids are growing at the speed that they're expected to grow for their age, that they're growing at the height that they should be for the population and for their families. So ideally, you will get picked up when you go see your provider, but sometimes you may notice it yourself when you're measuring your child along the wall, for example, and you notice that they haven't had much change in the last 6 months or year. So anytime you're concerned, again, we always encourage people to get checked out.
Yeah. Are there treatment options available for kids who aren't on that growth curve or at the very bottom of the growth curve?
There can be. It depends, again, on the cause. So if you don't make thyroid hormone, then your body can't grow. So then you need to take thyroid hormone, and then you can grow. If you don't make growth hormone, your body may not grow, and so then maybe you need to take growth hormone. Or certain genetic conditions may make growth different than the general population who doesn't have that genetic condition. And then sometimes there may be treatments appropriate and sometimes there may not be. So it just really depends on the cause.
Do you ever have a family seeking care because they just want their kid to be taller?
Sometimes. It's not very frequent in our population, but sometimes we, more often that is with the primary care provider. So they will see their primary care provider to see if they are normal height or concerning height. And if there is something concerning, they may get referred to an endocrinologist.
Thank you. And these treatments that you're mentioning, are these only done through endocrinologists, both this and the precocious puberty treatments, or are there pediatricians who also provide these treatments?
Generally, these are pretty specialized treatments that you have to have a lot of experience and training with to do correctly. So most of the time, it is with an endocrinologist. However, especially in Alaska where we have access issues or in other parts of the country where there's not very many specialists, then primary care providers or pediatricians may have extra training in order to be able to treat their patients. So most of the time you will get referred to a specialist, but there may be certain circumstances where that's not happening.
Okay. Well, we've covered quite a bit. I do want to talk about diabetes when we come back from our last break. So we're going to take another short break for the stations down the line. If you have a question or comment for our guest today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. We'll continue our discussion on pediatric hormone disorders when we return. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're hurting in your relationship or have been affected by sexual violence, Strong Hearts Native Helpline is a free 24/7 confidential and anonymous domestic, dating, and sexual violence helpline for Alaska Natives. Help is available by calling or texting 1-844-7-NATIVE or using the chat icon at strongheartshelpline.org. This message is sponsored by the Strong Hearts Native Helpline.
Welcome back to Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Our guest today is pediatric endocrinologist, Dr. Rachel Lesher. She is a physician that treats hormone disorders in children in Anchorage and travels throughout the state as part of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. She has cared for the Alaska Native population for over a decade. You can also join our conversation. Ask your questions about growth evaluations in children or the management of hormone disorders. Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Well, I know a definite staple of the work of pediatric endocrinologists and adult endocrinologists is the treatment of diabetes. And we often associate type 1 diabetes with onset in childhood and type 2 diabetes with onset in adulthood. Is type 2 diabetes also diagnosed in children?
Yes, absolutely. We see kids and adolescents with type 2 diabetes, and we can see adults who develop type 1 diabetes. So the adult and childhood diabetes monikers are no longer, are kind of outdated at this point.
I see. And how do you screen or test for type 1 and type 2 diabetes in children?
So there's a few different validated, reliable ways to screen for diabetes. Generally, for type 1 diabetes, we don't do much screening outside of research protocols. Sometimes if there's a strong family history of type 1 diabetes, then the other family members may have some screening done. But most of the time, we sort of just monitor for symptoms. Symptoms of diabetes include going to the bathroom all the time, being very thirsty or being very hungry, weight loss. And so if children are having those symptoms, we encourage them to see their provider to get tested. For type 2 diabetes, it is recommended to do screening. We can look at blood sugars or this test called hemoglobin A1C level, which looks at the average blood sugars, and it's recommended to screen children who have a family history of type 2 diabetes or who have signs that they may have diabetes, like this darkening of the skin called acanthosis nigricans or other risk factors that may increase their chances of having type 2 diabetes.
Are you seeing type 1 diabetes in those without a family history?
Absolutely. So type 1 diabetes is autoimmune, which means your immune system attacks yourself, in this case, the pancreas cells that make insulin. And so we know that autoimmunity can run in families, but the genetics of type 1 diabetes is very complicated. And so some people may have that increased risk of having type 1 because of a family history. But there's many people who no one else in the family has type 1 diabetes or even in other autoimmune conditions, and they still will develop it. So we're still learning a lot about what causes type 1 diabetes.
Can you maybe tell us about the distinction between type 1 and type 2?
Mm-hmm. So diabetes in general is a problem of not having enough insulin. Insulin is the hormone that's made in the pancreas, and it helps the body to use sugar. So sugar runs around through the blood, and then it's supposed to go into the cells to be used for energy. Just like you put gasoline into a car, you need the gas cap to open so you can put the gas in. The insulin is what helps that gas cap to open so the sugar can go in. And so with diabetes, your body is not able to make enough insulin to help the gas cap to open, so the sugar all gets stuck inside the blood. With type 1 diabetes, the cells that make insulin are destroyed by antibodies. And so they cannot make insulin. They always will need insulin for the rest of their lives. With type 2 diabetes, the pancreas can still make insulin, but the cells don't respond, so that gas cap is kind of rusted shut. And you have to make more and more and more insulin to kind of pry it open, and eventually the pancreas just kind of tires out and isn't able to make enough insulin to make the gas cap open. And so in both cases, the sugar gets stuck in the blood, and then that can cause all sorts of problems if it's not treated.
So there's effects of having a large amount or a high amount of sugar in the blood, but also there can be effects of having a high amount of insulin in the blood.
In type 2, potentially, the biggest problem is all the sugar in the blood. So the main problem is you've got the sugar in the blood, but it's not going to the places where it needs to go, so the body has no energy. And it starts trying to find other ways to get energy, so it starts eating itself. It eats your fat and your muscles to get energy that way. And so you get very tired and hungry because your body thinks it's starving. So that's one problem. And then the other issue is all the sugar in the blood becomes kind of toxic to the blood vessels, kind of like rust on pipes. And so the tiny little blood vessels that go into the eyes and the kidneys and the nerves are the most vulnerable. And so that high amount of sugar in the blood can injure those blood vessels and cause problems with blindness or kidney problems or nerve damage. So two sorts of problems that happen because of that.
Well, Dr. Lesher, families must love to see you because you explain things so well and it makes so much sense on many levels. So we're very blessed to have you here in Alaska. So you did mention some of those long-term effects of having untreated or poorly treated diabetes. What is the goal with treatment? You did mention hemoglobin A1C. Is there a specific hemoglobin A1C level that's a goal for those that have diabetes? And is it different for the goal for people who do not have diabetes?
Yep. So a normal hemoglobin A1C level is less than 5.7%. And that kind of correlates to what's considered normal blood sugars. But when you have diabetes, we shoot for a goal of less than 7%. Sometimes we can get it lower than that. But the reason we shoot for that goal is because we know that the A1C of less than 7 helps lower the risk for some of those long-term problems. And the reason we don't shoot for a normal A1C is because, number one, it's almost impossible because the pancreas is really, really sensitive. It's really good at detecting just how much sugar is in the blood, sending out insulin at just the right time and in just the right amount. And humans are just not as good as the pancreas. And so we're just not capable of exactly detecting the sugar in the blood and exactly sending out the right amount of insulin at the right time. So we give ourselves a little wiggle room.
So in a child that is not diabetic but maybe has risk factors, what is their goal hemoglobin A1C?
Well, we don't really have a goal hemoglobin A1C because hemoglobin A1C is the purpose of it is to monitor people who have diabetes. So a normal A1C is less than 5.7.
And is this something, because it is for monitoring, is this something that would be tested in children, or is it only tested if we have a suspicion that there's diabetes?
We generally will only test it if there's a suspicion of diabetes or, like I said, if there are risk factors for developing type 2 diabetes, and that can be used to screen for diabetes.
Excellent. We have an email. This one's a little bit complex, so we'll try to break it down. This email is from Laura. It says she has a 6-year-old that was born with a host of genetic defects due to a random mutation in her MEIS2 gene. So one of the things that the child has struggled with is hypoglycemic episodes, so low blood sugar episodes. And they've been monitoring with a continuous glucose monitor, which I think has probably revolutionized diabetes care. After several years, her medical team determined that she should start a very low dose of growth hormone therapy to stabilize the blood sugar. But the endocrinologist that she's been seeing, she's been having very difficult time achieving continuity of care with the doctors or providers moving in and out, and also having difficulty getting the medications approved with her insurance. So she's bringing up a few different issues. She didn't start the injections of the growth hormone because she doesn't want to if she doesn't have a solid supply of medication in place. So is there any danger that you're aware of starting low doses of hormones for the purpose of stabilizing blood sugar and then having to stop abruptly because of supply issues? Would they need to be weaned off because they live in a remote location?
Well, that you have a very good team around you for a complex, rare condition. So that is, first of all, very good that you have a great team. I can't answer that question specifically, not being your provider, but I can say so growth hormone is important for sugar. Growth hormone obviously is important for growth, like it sounds, but it also controls sugar or helps support sugar because it works counteractive to insulin. And so in cases if there is actual growth hormone deficiency where you're not making growth hormone, then that some people, especially babies, can have low blood sugar because of not making growth hormone. Usually older kids who don't make growth hormone don't have low blood sugar, but everyone is different, especially with different conditions. So it is good to work with an endocrinologist because we're the main prescribers of growth hormone and can help decide when it's appropriate and when it's not appropriate working with the team. But it is very difficult to get because it's very, very expensive, unfortunately. And so there are several requirements that have to be met to prove that it's going to be effective.
Can you start and stop something like this? Or is this something that has to be weaned?
In this specific situation, I couldn't say because, again, it's not my patient. Sometimes if growth hormone is lack of growth hormone is causing hypoglycemia, then when you stop it, you are going to keep having hypoglycemia.
Ooh, right.
For sure. But right. It's hard to say for this specific situation.
Right. I would think it would be kind of different for, let's say, if you're doing the puberty injections and you stop that, that could be quite detrimental. Then you may go through puberty at that point. But yes, hypoglycemic episodes can be very difficult for the child and for the family member, and especially if your child is going off to school and experiencing these hypoglycemic episodes. The insurance issue is very difficult, I think, for these medications and getting approval and pre-authorization and things like that. And some medications do have assistance programs. So I'm not sure about your medication, but some of them do. And so that would be an excellent question for the endocrinologist to see, because they usually know, you know, that information, if your program has that or not, to try to get that medication. But I think, yes, some of the prices are so high, which is very difficult. Okay, I think that is the last email for that. One of the things I wanted to talk about with the diabetes is the continuous glucose monitor and what that is, and whether, basically tell us about that continuous glucose monitor.
So like I said, our purpose with diabetes is trying to get that A1C down at least below 7% to decrease the risk of complications. And one of the limiting factors at getting it down is low blood sugars. So if your sugars are too low, then you can have all kinds of problems related to that. And CGMs, or continuous glucose monitors, help to monitor the sugar all the time. They're not monitoring the sugar in the blood. They're monitoring the sugar in an interstitial fluid, which is that fluid that runs through the tissues. And so the companies who make CGMs have created these like computer algorithms that help to approximate what the sugar is in the blood. And then you can get that information in real time through like a Bluetooth connection 24/7. And so they really have revolutionized the management of diabetes, because now we're not just like wondering what your sugar is throughout the day. We can know what it is all the time. So it's been a real game changer, especially, you know, prior to that, we were testing sugar and poking fingers multiple times a day. Prior to that, people were measuring the sugar in their urine. And prior to that, people were tasting their urine to see if it tasted sweet. So it's really been a game changer.
And now you can actually monitor your child while they're at school and see what
Yes.
their blood sugars are doing. Does that mean you can eat whatever you want to eat?
Well, I don't think any of us should eat whatever we want to eat all
Right.
day, every day. But with type 1 diabetes, especially, we want to live our lives and we want our kids to live their lives. And so we want to find ways to help them live a long life that's enjoyable.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dr. Lesher. We thank our guest today for being with us. And thanks also to our audio engineer, Tobin Shelby, and our producer, Adeline Baxter. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants, and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.